Fellowship, as here we're looking at the responses of Jacob and Sons in regards to hearing the news of the rape of Jacob's daughter Dinah. Jacob decides at this point in time to play Agent 007, to be under the radars and stay silent in regards to the situation. While on the surface it may look as if the reader is going to be kept in suspense or not going to be informed in regards to why he reacts this way, we can connect his attitude now with the words that he speaks at the end of the chapter in his fear in regards to his reputation, as well as harm, destruction coming to him and his family otherwise. And it is a case in which he puts priorities of his own self and other aspects of life over that which is right, that which he should be doing in regards to this whole situation at hand. And what is abnormal is his lack of emotional response, especially of righteous indignation in regards to the rape of Dinah. So, again, we see the lesson comes about in regards to Operation Fear in the believer's life, causing them, in many cases, not to make the right applications in regards to life just because they're afraid why somebody might think otherwise or other actions that may occur after the fact. And the whole irony in regards to this is because of his silence, his sons take charge, and they excel in their STA escapade in regards to it under extreme righteous indignation, which turns into sin anger, and he finds himself in a worse situation than what it was to begin with in simply pursuing civil justice in regards to his daughter, Dinah. And in between the situation, the author here in verse 6 informs us that Hamor was the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. Hamor, the reason for the inclusion at this point in time in the context, is designed now to be, if you will, a silent rebuke to Jacob. He has the initiative, he has the courage to step in and at least seek to take care of the affairs of his son upon his father, his son's request, whereas Jacob does nothing in regards to defending his daughter Dinah otherwise in this respect. And in that sense, and the Bible is not shy in regards to bringing out examples like that. An unbeliever is a rebuke to the believer, a priest who is operating under sin fear and not willing to faith rest and exercise the courage of application of doctrine otherwise in regards to their life. Obviously, this sin was a gross perversion in regards to the phallic culture of Israel. It's a sin that otherwise under the law is punishable by death. And obviously the sons make it very clear that the right doctrinal principle, that a thing like this should not be done in Israel. But yet Jacob decides to stay silent and, if you will, procrastinate in regards to doing anything. And he finds, as I stated, he finds himself in this case really a situation that would stir up fear even greater than what he had to address initially. So Hamor becomes a rebuke to Jacob. That's where we left off in point 25, page 9 of our notes. Hamor in this vein in verse 6 is an open rebuke to Jacob. That's what's intended by the author. Why the author mentions simply Hamor, even though we know by later context that Shechem's with him, why he only mentions Hamor in this context, in this immediate context of Jacob being silent. And it's to show the two approaches of the two fathers in regards to their children. So that's point 26. He presents himself as one should expect from a parental authority to take charge on behalf of their children living under the roof in time of conflict. It was a conflict in both cases. at least Tamar has the guts to go and approach Jacob, a potential adversary, not knowing exactly how Jacob's going to respond to all this. But he's still going to go out and try to take care of the issues in regards to his son. Jacob leaves it to others to deal with the situation. Obviously, discernment must come in to play in regards to one's exercise of authority, but one, when one's in a position of authority, ultimately, they are held accountable in regards to those things that occur otherwise, that they are not willing to exercise their authority with respect to a certain circumstance or situation. So 27, this contrast explains why the author omits mentioning Shechem's presence in our verses, as he wants the readers to focus on the two fathers at hand. Verse 7 then provides a climatic contrast designed as a rebuke for Jacob's passivity. This is the explicit rebuke now. The father, Hamor, is more of a silent rebuke to match Jacob's silence in regards to the situation. 29, in fact, the totality of verse 7 puts the sons in a much better light than that of their father. Verse 7, now the sons of Jacob came in from the field when they heard it. The men were grieved and they were angry, very angry, exceedingly, because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, for such a thing ought not to be done. So the totality of verse 7 puts the sons here in this context, immediate context, in a much better light than that of their father. 30, this from those that will ultimately show no control over their anger. They'll go berserk. See. So there you have it, in a mixture of right and wrong, that's the Christian life. That's the reality of Christian life. Under your SCA, 1 minute, in fellowship the other. Uh-oh. Excuse me. That's where you end. I'm an abuser of animals. I did not kill that wasp. I only crippled it. It's going to die a slow death now. So I'm just thanking God for not letting him sting me at this point. I'm not allergic to him, but it still doesn't feel very good. All right. The wasp. Now, what symbolism can I attach to that? Oh, I know, the demon locust. All right, let's get back into this. So, you have a twofold irony that's wrapped up in regards to Jacob's failure to apply. One by Hamor, Shechem's father, a rebuke to his silence. And now one by his sons, who at least initially had the doctrine correct. Their problem is they're going to abuse that doctrine. They're going to go overboard. And they're going to let the righteous indignation turn into sin anger. That's one of the things that you've got to look out for when you get into righteous indignation. Make sure it does not turn into sin anger. Christians are called upon to tolerate a lot in terms of forgiveness and attitude towards others, compassion and these things. But there are certain things in society and certain activities that go on that we should not tolerate. Just like society shouldn't tolerate certain actions. See? And this is one of those actions that shouldn't have been tolerated by the authority. But because the authority did not exercise their authority to begin with, then others take charge and they, if you will, skewer it with their own brand of STA activity. So 31, the balance of justice in this event from Jacob's family is skewered to the extreme on both accounts. That is apathy on the part of Jacob versus abusing justice and revenge on the part of his sons. God tells us to leave room for his vengeance. Vengeance is mine, says the Lord. You have civil laws and other aspects of legal reactions to things and things that you're supposed to do. We're not to get under revenge, but that's what the brothers end up doing. Dinah's brothers end up doing in this whole ordeal. So you have the two extremes where something in the middle should have been the correct thing. 32, the news of the crime also reaches the ears of Jacob's son, and they came in from the field when they heard. Bo-men, ha-sadeh, sadeh, kaf, shema. 33, the reaction was mental distress and righteous indignation. And the men grieved, and they were very angry. Wow, asab, ha-ish, wow, karal, lamed, meod. Again, there are certain things that in one context can be righteous, not simple, but in another context can be simple. Anger is one of them. In the right context, we are commanded to fear God. So, well, that's fear, not anger. But otherwise, we're told to do it in one instance. We saw David's reaction. We see God's reaction in regards to certain activities, in regards to Israel. His wrath, his anger burned, as it might state. Obviously, that's righteous. But then when it steps over into the boundary of taking revenge, and it comes from and stems from hate and things of this nature, rather than the doctrinal reflection upon the situation, then it becomes simple. Sex is another area. I mean, sex within the divine institution of marriage is completely and totally legitimate. It's supposed to be fun. Anything outside of marriage, then sex is simple, see. So, again, you hear people just throw verses out, wrench them out of context. They have no idea what they're talking about in regards to things. But doctrine, you have a clear read in regards to these things. And righteous indignation, to be angry over a simple evil act that occurs, is completely legitimate. So the sons grieved, and they were exceedingly angry. 34, now the idea in the Hebrew is that they were so angry they could hardly, quote, think straight, end quote, is how I would put it. That's your verb atsab, which means vexed, plus karad, mayod, burned exceedingly. You might say, you know, so mad they could spit or something like that, but really it's just their emotions grabbed them under anger, under righteous indignation. And they don't think straight ultimately. 35, now the cause of their emotions, and anger is an emotion, it's a response. Emotions are designed for us to recognize feelings and responses in regards to things. Emotions are not to rule us. Emotions are not to govern us. Our thinking is to govern us. Funding churches today, they ride on emotions, they promote emotions. But emotions are temporary, the responder. The actuator is your brain computer, your thinking, your soul, etc. So the cause of emotions they then rightly attribute, point 35, because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter. Ki Nabalah Asah Bet Israel Lamed Shekab Eth Bath Jacob. 36, some ask if this comment is a narrator's opinion. Moses simply inserting his opinion in the narrative, or the opinion of the sons of Jacob, or both. The phrase in Israel is striking, considering the relative short history of this term to signify their national identity. Third generation. And the sons, if this is their opinion, not just Moses, that would be very striking, that they consider themselves already as a peoples, as a nation. 38, it subtly illustrates the doctrinal frame of reference having been assimilated in Jacob's household. People often get focused in on regards to people's actions, such as Jacob and what the sons and his sons, what they do in regards to this. And a lot of times the excuses is they'll dismiss it in regards to their ignorance to doctrine. They didn't know better, or they weren't believers, you know, they're really legalists, or something like that. No, the fact is that Jacob and his household, his sons, were all believers. Jacob is definitely positive phase two. And maybe some question in regards to how all of his sons turned out in the line of Christ. I'm in a contention that the line of Christ also was positive phase two in that respect. But sin is not through ignorance of doctrine in and of itself. You could have years of doctrine and still engage in sin against a very doctrine that you're aware of. You know, the reality of living in the flesh. And they had a frame of reference. They knew what was right and what was wrong according to doctrine. They recognized that they are God's chosen people through the Abrahamic covenant, that they are heirs to it. I guarantee you, Jacob made sure this doctrine was taught throughout their household. He understood it. See? So you don't get caught off balance when a believer, otherwise, you know, may have years of doctrine, does something stupid. It's not like, you know, they didn't know. That's the weakness of the flesh often. And it's not an excuse in regards to sinning. We don't excuse sinning. We don't cater to it. We just recognize it that it's a fact of life. No matter how much doctrine you got, it is a constant inner battle that we face every day. So the phrase in Israel, at this point in time, in the history of the line of Abraham, is very striking, and as I said, subtly, and not so subtly once you recognize it. It really illustrates spiritually that they recognize the doctrine. But they're going to get under their STAs, and they're going to do what they're going to do. So 39, his sons, like Jacob, were not ignorant of Bible doctrine in spite of their STA shenanigans. How many times you hear the defense regards to people, criminals who do bad things, you know. Well, they just didn't know better. Bull hockey. What, they don't have a conscience? If they don't have a conscience, execute them immediately. You don't want that person in your society. See? I'm not talking about somebody that might be mentally deficient. Grossly deficient. But even that's wore out excuse. I've had friends and people that might have been considered mentally deficient, but they still knew the difference between right and wrong. 40, we should consider the statement here as the opinion of both author and sons. Moses agreeing, if you will, if you're going to look at it in both contexts. Because the law says, you know, this is wrong. This is a sin. In fact, rape is to be punishable by death under the Mosaic law. And to think that the principle was not operable before the Mosaic law was written is, I think, naive, like a lot of doctrine. You know, we're not told a lot of the doctrinal things that went on in regards to before the Mosaic law came about. So you can pick up by innuendo and by examples that they understood the theology of sacrifice, the doctrine behind it, what's right and what's wrong, etc. So, anyway. Now the Hebrew noun nebala, disgraceful, as it's translated, is used elsewhere of a crime punishable by death. Deuteronomy 22:21. Actually, the sexual sins that are involved here can be a little bit confusing in the English. You got to sort these things out. It should start verse 22. Actually, here it would be better. Even though our word may be in verse 21, and purging the evil from among you, they shall stone her to death. But verse 22, just to give you an example here in regards to rape. If a man is found lying with a married woman, then both of them shall die. Adultery is punishable by death. The man who lay with the woman, it doesn't make any difference their ages or anything of this nature. If they're caught in the act, they are to remove from society. Kill them all and let God sort it out. That's the idea here. Thus you shall purge the evil from Israel. If there is a girl as a virgin engaged to a man, another man finds her in the city and lies with her, he shall bring them both out to the gate of the city and shall stone them to death. The promise to another individual. The girl, because she did not cry out in the city. Cry out in the city looks at the fact that this was not an instance of rape. And the man, because he had violated his neighbor's wife, once is engaged and promised to another, then that's almost at the same level as being married. Thus you shall purge the evil from among you. But if in the field a man finds a girl who is engaged, the man forces her, lies with her, then only the man who lies with her shall die. That's rape. But he shall do nothing to the girl. There is no sin of the girl worthy of death. For just as a man rises against his neighbor and murders him, so is this case. It is to be equal to murder. Rape is. When he found her in the field, the engaged girl cried out, but there was no one to save her. See? While verse 28 may look like a case of rape, it's not. Because you have no crying out. See, you got to understand those terms, how they're being used there in the language. That's where the guy may more or less force himself in verse 28, but the woman submits and doesn't struggle to
get away from it. Man finds a girl who's a virgin, is not engaged to Caesar, and lies with her. They are discovered. Then he's got to marry her. And guess what? No divorce for those people. Under the law. You want it that bad? You live with it. There you are, the rest of your life. Joshua 7:15. And again, our word was actually in verse 21 there. She committed an act of folly, and she should be stoned to death. Folly is our term. All right, Joshua 7:15. I just want to keep that straight. But the other part was directly attributable to what we're dealing with. It shall be that the one who is taken with the things under the ban, in terms of what was allowed in possession or not, shall be burned with fire, he and all that belongs to him, because he has transgressed the covenant of the Lord, and because he's committed a disgraceful thing in Israel. Our term, again, associated with capital punishment. They're burned with fire. Judges 19:23-24. This is that passage dealing with the Levite's concubine and the tribe of Benjamin. And there was a sect of them that went homo. And you almost have a similar situation as Sodom and Gomorrah with the angelic visitors with the men of that city, Sodom. Anyway, verse 23, then the man, the owner of the house, went out to them and said to them, "No, my fellows, please do not act so wickedly. Since this man has come into my house, do not commit this act of folly." Homosexual is supposed to be a crime punishable by death. Verse 24, here's my virgin daughter and his concubine. The visitor's concubine. Please let me bring them out that you may ravish them, do to them whatever you wish, but do not commit such an act of folly against this man. And one might think, well, that was pretty cold. Give up the daughter and the guy's concubine. But it was one of those situations where one sin is going to have one impact in regards to the nation of Israel, whereas the other sin would be a lesser impact, basically. Not to excuse that, but he felt he was in that situation to sacrifice. And homosexuality, that's just how detrimental it is to a society in God's eyes. And we think it's all right, or the society starts to think that it's all right. And then compare chapter 20, verse 6. And I took hold of my concubine, cut her in pieces, sent her throughout the land of Israel's inheritance, for they had committed a lewd and disgraceful act in Israel. And God's remedy was for them to go in and wipe out this particular tribe of Benjamites. And they had hell doing it. Not all homosexuals are the limp-wristed types of people that they often act like, the effeminate. Many of them are very mean. The Antichrist, he's homosexual. By all aspects of the history, that he also is homosexual. Now, the scriptures make that clear, as well as the history of Alexander the Great points to that very fact, that he liked young boys. See? So understand, they're still males, and they had the strength of a male and could be just as vicious
And some of them are very vicious. Ask anybody that's served time in prison how vicious these kind of dudes can be. I mean, it just makes that's the way you want to look at it. You know? The jackasses. I put it that way. 2 Samuel 13:12. All right, I better get off that subject. Righteous indignation. And you think about it and you go, man. And everybody else, they're all right. Why? Because maybe they're one of their children has become one. Transgender. What is transgender? It's nothing more than another title for a homosexual. Come on. You know? And they think that people are going to buy this stuff, and people do. What did I say? I was not going to speak about that anymore. 2 Samuel 13:12. But she answered him, "No, my brother, do not violate me." This is Ammon and Tamar in that situation. "For such a thing is not done in Israel. Do not do this disgraceful thing." There's your term. So 42, it carries a nuance of that which is senseless and shameful. Senseless and shameful. Foolish. Now the term is also used 13 times throughout Leviticus 11. Rendered as that which is unclean. Examples here, not to cite all the verses, but just to give you an example, Leviticus 11, chapter 11, verses 8, 11, 24, 25, and 27. Our term, Nebala. 11 verse 8, "You shall not eat of their flesh," the pig. Why cows have hooves and not feet? Because they lactose. Verse 8, "You shall not eat of their flesh nor touch their carcasses. They are unclean to you." Verse 11, "And they shall be abhorrent to you. You may not eat of their flesh and their carcasses. They shall detest. You shall detest." Verse 24, "By these moreover you shall be made unclean. Whoever touches their carcasses become unclean until evening." 25, "Concerning all animals which divide the hoof." That's what reminded me of the jokes. It's not like I just pull this stuff out of thin air now. Doctrine stimulates me in all that I do. Well, not too many people laughed at that anyway. Verse 25, "Whoever picks up at their carcasses shall wash his clothes and be unclean until evening." 27, "Also whatever walks on his paws among all the creatures that walk on all fours are unclean to you. Whoever touches their carcasses become unclean until evening." Now, people would touch these things. I mean, it's just out of natural course of life. And if you touch a dead corpse, you're rendered unclean. Well, how are you going to bury somebody? You got to touch them. See, all that teaches contact with sin by the individual, priest or whoever it might be. So 44, clean versus unclean, teaches the doctrine of separation in association with sin. That's what the doctrine of clean and unclean, in part, teaches, the doctrine of separation. You're trying to refrain yourself from engaging in these activities. When it happens, you're rendered unclean. As we say, you've engaged in personal sin. That's what it symbolized. That's what it taught. And hence the need for a rebound, etc. Some aspects of separation might occur in certain acts of uncleanness, like the leprosy scenario, as we've dealt with. You know, but anyway. It definitely points to the doctrine of separation again. 45, "Intended or not, the boy's anger condemns not only the crime of rape, but also the failure to apply separation." If you think I'm stretching too far, point 47, "Ironically, failure to separate leads future Israel into much of their spiritual demise," because they wouldn't separate as a nation. their excuses of embracing others. They find themselves drugged down spiritually often. Joshua 23, 6 and 7. Joshua giving his farewell address here in the context. Verse 1, and it came about after many days when Yahweh had given rest to Israel from all their enemies on every side. And Joshua was old, advanced years after the battles of the conquest. That Joshua called for all Israel, verse 2, for all their elders and their heads and their judges and their officers, and said to them, I am old, advanced in years. Verse 3, and you have seen all that the Yahweh your God has done to all these nations because of you. For the Lord your God is He who has been fighting for you. So you have a portion to you. Verse 4, these nations which remain as an inheritance for your tribes, with all the nations which I have cut off, from the Jordan even to the Great Sea, Mediterranean, toward the setting of the sun. Verse 5, and the Lord your God, He shall thrust them out from before you and drive them from before you, and you shall possess their land, just as the Lord your God promised you. Now, Israel's never possessed all the real estate that was promised to them. That's because they never got to the spiritual level in order for that to occur yet. Now, that will come under their King Jesus Christ to establish that the realm of righteousness. Verse 6, be very firm then to keep and do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, so you may not turn aside from it to the right or to the left. As we say, don't go legalistic or liberal in regards to doctrine. Don't omit doctrine. Don't add to it the traditions of men, all these things. Doctrine is a perfect balance of justice and righteousness, and we are to adhere to it. In its very form of which it's presented in the Scriptures. You start straying from it, then you'll find yourself getting involved in regards to the evil of the cosmos around you. And that's verse 7, to stick to the straight and narrow of doctrine and order for the purpose that you may not associate with these nations. These which remain among you, or mention the name of their gods, or make anyone swear by them, or serve them, or bow down to them, not to start catering to their ideologies, human viewpoint ideologies, things of that nature, their religions, their pagan cultures, their STAs, what they pursue in life. So, verses 12 and 13, or verse 10, we'll just go ahead and read it on through. One of your men fistified 1,000, for the Lord your God is He who fights for you, just as He promised you, God blessing your military. Something that has been sorely lacking with ours for a while. So take diligent heed to yourselves to love the Lord your God. Verse 12, here's your warning, for if you ever go back and cling to the rest of these nations, these which remain among you, and intermarry with them, so that you associate with them, and they with you, know with certainty that the Lord your God will not continue to drive these nations out from before you, but they shall be a snare and a trap to you, and a whip on your sides, and thorns in your eyes, till you perish from off this good land which the Lord your God has given you under the fifth cycle of discipline. And 1 Kings 11, 2. Solomon, he did a stint in reversionism. By all indications in regards to Scripture, the wisest man that's ever probably walked on this planet. It's just how easy it is to come to the STA. Now, King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh. And part of his issues spiritually was whom he associated with, whom he took to bed with him as his wife.
And he embraced pagan cultures in this effect. And these all had influence in regards to his life. The Moabite, the Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women. Verse 2, from the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the sons of Israel, you shall not associate with them, neither shall they associate with you, for they will surely turn your heart away after their gods. Solomon held fast to these in love.
In his STA pursuits of life. See, the same kind of love that emulates, if you will, the unbeliever Shechem. The cosmos, see, the world says there's a variety of choices in regards to your right opposite number. Take your pick. Bible doctrine says, no, God has a right opposite number for you. And with doctrine, you wait upon God and you figure out who it is. This whole dating scene, etc. I'm not legalistic. I recognize people got to get to know each other and things of that nature. But as it's presented in the cosmos, most of us, the cultures we've come out of, all it is cosmic approach in regards to otherwise waiting for one's right opposite number. So we live and we learn. But if you've learned, it's best to adhere to it. 48, the final phrase ultimately makes clear that the brother's reaction is the right one, and therefore civil justice should be pursued in this situation. Father, again, we thank you for the truth of your word. We ask God, the Holy Spirit, continue to light us to these things. In Jesus' name, amen.